Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm absolutely delighted to be joined on the podcast today by Professor Kieran McQuinn. Kieran is a research professor who works on the quarterly economic commentary and macroeconomic and housing related projects in the ESRI, which is the Economic and Social Research Institute. He's worked with the Irish Central Bank. He's worked with Chagask before, and he has a PhD in economics from Maynooth University. And he is also current professor, adjunct professor of economics at University College Cork and Trinity College Dublin. Kieran, thanks so much for joining me today on Reboot.
Not at all. Thank you very much for the invitation, Rory.
Kieran, you've been doing quite a bit on housing for quite a while. But I think one of the papers that you wrote that got a lot of attention, and I think rightfully so, was the one you did in June, which has a fantastic title, and I'd love to ask you where you came up the title for. Well, I know it's from within the paper, but just it's so brilliant. And the title of its paper is, "With G greater than R, should we be borrowing to increase Irish housing supply?" But beyond the title, the paper received a lot of attention because essentially you're making the argument that we have the potential and ability to significantly increase our ability to borrow, that is, the state has the ability, and build social, public, affordable housing. Maybe you could outline, I suppose, what is the main points you're kind of making in that article? And I think for listeners, they would have a certain information about housing, and we cover housing a lot on the podcast, but I think not all of them are going to be economists. And maybe just explain, you know, from as an economist, what is kind of the key case you're making here in the paper?
Yeah, so very happy to discuss it. Yeah, I think the paper, as you say, Rory, I mean, I worked in the central bank for a good few years, and that's where I suppose I started doing a lot of work on housing. And in particular, looking at house prices, and the central bank, I suppose, is interested in things like financial stability and where do they see house prices going? Do they think they're going to go up or fall or, you know, stay the same?
Yeah.
So that's where a lot of my initial interest in housing came from. And then we had the crash, of course, the financial crash. And then I became very interested in the whole issue of mortgage arrears, because that was the next, you know, that was a big, huge issue at the time, obviously, and the related issue of negative equity. So myself and a colleague, Yvonne McCarthy, we started to dig around and see if we could get data on what was the best way to look at that. And we came up with looking at using the SILC. Yvonne did, in fairness, she had worked using SILC for a different research area, and she suggested that it might be well worth looking at it for housing and affordability in particular. So then we did that piece of work, a variety of different studies at the time. And then when I came to the Institute, I thought it would be interesting to use SILC to look at affordability in the housing market. Now, people had been, John Fitzgerald and David Duffy had used SILC, but I suppose I was interested in carrying on kind of the work that I'd started with Yvonne and the bank, and just doing a much broader piece on
just
affordability.
Explain, pause briefly.
Yeah.
SILC is not a piece of cloth.
Sorry, SILC is the Survey on Income and Living Conditions. It's funny. It's one of these things. The CSO use it, and it's compiled mainly to look at things like income, affordability, you know, stress, financial stress, I suppose, and people's living standards, basically. And it's been used extensively in the ESRI to look at issues like poverty, particularly on the social side. However, there's actually quite, we found, and it was, in fairness, again, it was Yvonne who picked this up, there was quite a lot, or is still quite a lot of questions in SILC, which are very useful for looking at the housing market. Now, it was not constructed to look at the housing market and look at housing affordability, but they just happened to ask a lot of questions in the SILC that are very useful for that purpose. The CSO themselves were slightly bemused that we were using SILC for this purpose. And, you know, they were kind of almost trying to suggest that we shouldn't be using it. But we kind of said, well, look, this is the best that we can get. I mean, it's reasonably timely. I mean, it comes out with a lag, of course, but there's anything up to around 50 questions, I think, in SILC that look at the whole issue of housing, and in particular, that can get at the whole housing affordability issue and can get at it from a distributional point of view. So you can go right across the distribution to look at affordability and come up with different indicators of affordability. And, you know, you could talk all day about those indicators, but that's, I think, the attraction of Silk. So, you know, when I came to the Institute, we started to do a lot of work on that. And also, I suppose it was around about the time when I came to the Institute, was around 2014, 2015, the housing issue was beginning to come back again. So, you know, it had kind of gone away, or you had the crash and the crisis. And then suddenly we were back into a situation where house prices were picking up. But it was evident to everyone, of course, that supply wasn't. And so I suppose I became particularly interested in the supply issue at that time. And I suppose became particularly interested in looking at the fact that, you know, not just that the private sector wasn't reacting or wasn't, you know, meeting the demand that was there, but that, you know, the government had also, the state sector had obviously stepped back from providing housing. And I think that was something that had really began to struck me back then. And it's something that we talked about quite a bit in the commentary. We would have made the point that we felt there should have been an increase in the provision of social and affordable housing. And that tied in then with the work that we were doing on affordability, where it became very evident to us that affordability was just a huge issue in the economy, you know, and that you had particularly, you had people, cohorts of people who were paying out huge amounts of their income on a month-to-month basis for, you know, mainly for renting in some cases, but also in terms of the mortgage size that people were taking out, you know, that there was huge, an underlying kind of what we call a structural issue around affordability. It wasn't just something that came up yesterday or the day before. It was something that has been there ever since, as far back as we could go on the data, which I think is 2003. So, you know, and from that, it just became evident that you really, the market was not going to provide the amount of housing, you know, for, you know, the kind of housing that was needed, particularly at the social and affordable side. The government had stepped back, and it just seemed to me that the obvious policy response was that the government needed to step up and increase its provision of social and affordable housing. So that was one side of it. The other side then, and I suppose we're always conscious when you make those kind of policy announcements or policy prescriptions, whatever way you want to call it, is the issue, well, can the government afford it? You know, yeah. I mean, you can talk all day about the government should increase expenditure here, it should increase expenditure there, but, you know, we also look at the public finances. So, you know, you can't, you know, you have to be able to square the circle or reconcile them and say, well, is there the scope there from a fiscal point of view to actually really seriously ramp up the state provision of housing? And so that's where I had been doing work on the fiscal side, just in terms of looking at sustainability of the debt, particularly given the large increase in borrowing that we were doing around COVID. And so it was just kind of looking at that and taking an approach that other people had adopted. I just said, well, let's look at the Irish case. And of course, as you refer to, the title of the paper is With G Greater Than R. The kind of key dynamic that you look at when you're looking at the whole issue of borrowing is you're comparing how you think the economy is going to grow against the cost of the debt. That's the kind of, the G is the growth rate of the economy. The R is the cost of borrowing. And it's very clear, I think, to most people, if they were to look at it, obviously interest rates have been very, very low as far as borrowing is concerned. It's not guaranteed that they're going to stay low, but nonetheless, they are low. There's, you know, fairly compelling reasons why they're likely to stay low. And there's been a lot done in the literature as to why interest rates have fallen, you know, so persistently over the last 10, 15 years across Western economies. So, you know, the interest rate outlook looks like it's set to remain relatively low over the short to medium term. And I think most of the analysis that we would have done in-house in the Institute, in terms of, we do a lot of work with my colleague Adele Bergen, there's a lot of work on COSMO, the large scale econometric model, forecasting out how the economy is likely to evolve. It appeared to us that, you know, the growth rate of the economy was likely to be quite strong going forward. So therefore, that key ratio of the G and the R was likely to be very favorable to the domestic economy going forward. And that enabled you to, from a sustainability point of view, enabled the government, if you like, to engage in some degree of borrowing, you know, relatively mild, relatively low deficit, but still one that you could adopt. And that would generate quite a lot of additional revenue for the state going forward. So that it was those kind of two areas coming together, the fiscal side, looking at how you could you afford this, and then the key policy prescription, I suppose, on the housing side, on the supply side, that really you needed the government to seriously ratchet up and increase the level of investment that's required. Now, obviously, there's other areas of investment that the government needs to prioritize as well. We're well aware of those. The climate change agenda could be, you know, could pose significant challenges, you know, from a revenue point of view, in terms of, I think, yeah, there's significant investment required there. We've seen Sláinte Care in the last couple of weeks be coming back onto the political agenda. That obviously will require increased investment. So it's clear that the government faces quite a few challenges in this regard. So it was also kind of with that in mind to say that, look, there is this possible revenue stream available without damaging the public finances. You know, I don't think anybody wants to go back to the kind of situation, you know, when the reason I became interested in economics was that I'm old enough, I can remember back to the dark days of the 1980s when, you know, you had 16% unemployment and the debt to GDP ratio was crazy and all those kind of, it was a kind of a bleak place to be. So I don't think anybody wants to revisit that. But at the same time, there is, you know, it's just a case of looking at it and seeing, is there the possibility that you could do something on a sustainable basis? And I think my answer and conclusion would be that you can engage in this form of borrowing over a period of time, which could provide the state with additional resources.
And there's a lot of, I think, things to try and unpack here in and understand for people, because a lot of the debate at a headline level is just, you hear it like, oh, you know, the debt is so high and we can't take on more debt and this is, you know, unsustainable. Mm. And even with these other pressures, you know, we're seeing, as you refer to in the paper and even in the Housing for All plan, the capital allocation is likely to be this year and around, you know, slightly above a billion, maybe 1.2, 1.3 billion to housing. But in fact, you make the recommendation in the paper that that should be doubled to over 2 billion. And there's actual that capacity there to borrow, you know, 4 to 7 billion additionally. And that, as you referred to in the paper, would be fiscally prudent. What's the case that can be made for increasing our debt sustainably? Because I still think that needs to be explained to people. How can we do that? Because people just hear, oh my God, we're just taking on more debt. We can't afford this.
Well, funny enough, we have our, I think I was saying to you, we have our next commentary is coming out next week, the 7th of October. And we're going to be going into it in some detail. There's been a lot of commentary on this, and I think some of it is a little bit misguided. Maybe some of it is almost trying to, people maybe are genuinely concerned, and people are obviously genuinely concerned when they hear the figures and they hear the numbers about the debt levels and the increase in borrowing. The key issue, though, I suppose, and from an economist's point of view, you look at is your ability to sustain that debt. So usually you don't just look at the debt itself. You don't just say, well, whatever the debt is, it's 290 billion, which, you know, is a huge figure. It's a massive figure. It's an enormous figure. And it's much bigger than it was 15 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever. So it is huge. But the key issue is that you look at it relative to the size of the economy. That's the key issue. And no matter what metric you use, and obviously there's been a lot of debate about what's the appropriate metric to use, because you have the whole issue with GDP in an Irish context, and that is, you know, there's a lot of funny stuff, to put it mildly, going on in GDP. But no matter which metric you use, whether it's debt to GDP, whether it's debt to GNI star, which is the one, for instance, that the Fiscal Council favor, you can see that there's been a substantial improvement in that ratio over the last 10 years. So we all know one of the reasons why the debt is so large is because of the financial crisis back in, you know, between 2008 and 2011. And I'm sure you could devote an entire series of podcasts to that and what have you. But the bottom line here is that because the government revenues became so dependent on the housing market, when the housing market collapsed, the revenues associated with that collapsed. And then obviously we had to bail out the banks, or we ended up bailing out the banks. So that caused the huge increase in our debt. So that's the reason why the debt is so large to start with. But the key issue is that because the economy has been growing so strongly over the last 7 or 8 years, our ability to sustain that debt has been improving significantly. Now, we're still at the upper echelons in terms of if we look at, we'll say, across countries, but it's clear that we're improving very, very quickly in terms of how we sustain that debt. And I suppose where the paper is coming from is, what do we want to do going forward? Do we want to continue to drive down that ratio as quickly and as aggressively as possible? So let's just call it the debt to output ratio. Let's not specify whether it's GDP or GNI star. Do we want to continue to drive that down as aggressively as we can? Or do we want to do, which is what we're suggesting, continue to improve that ratio so you continue to reduce the debt relative to output, but maybe not as quickly as what we've been doing in the recent past? So I guess that's the kind of the difference between, we'll say, what we're suggesting and maybe what some other people are talking about.
And I think, you know, that's explained very well. And I think that, you know, if we look at it, particularly around housing, I think there's a number of other areas, and my economics lecture is back to Professor PJ Drudy, who I had in Trinity, you know, introduced the great John Maynard Keynes, and the idea of, you know, borrowing for investment isn't the same as just, you know, current spending. And that we don't, that I think the question that you bring up in the paper really, really well is, well, in a way, what's the alternative? Because what we're facing if we don't borrow, as you're recommending, is, as you describe in the paper, another decade and probably longer of a sustained housing crisis, of, you know, the human impact of that, but also the economic impact of that on competitiveness, on the ability to develop the economy. So it's almost like the not borrowing is a short-term view rather than taking a long-term view.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that, you're exactly right. The reason we identified, I mean, obviously there's the social side of it in terms of the housing crisis. And, you know, like everybody, you kind of feel from a social point of view, or, you know, that issue has to be addressed. But from an economics point of view, it's clear that it needs to be addressed as well. As you said, the competitiveness angle is a very important issue going forward, particularly because, you know, anecdotally, we would know from talking to people that multinationals increasingly, when they're coming to invest, one of the key issues they're asking about now is the housing market. And what are you doing about the housing market? They may come along and seek to pay very good and attractive wages, but if their employees have to fork out a large proportion of that on rents, then, you know, clearly it's a big issue for them. So that is a particular, the competitiveness issue. And again, this goes back to the study that we did on affordability to see just the fact that this has been an ongoing issue in Irish society over a long period of time, that there is a substantial, you know, significant portion of people out there who are paying very, very high rents, are paying in terms of their mortgages are particularly high. And in doing cross-country comparisons, it's evident that Ireland is an outlier in terms of how high our house prices are and how high rent levels are. It's clear that the cost of housing in Ireland is as high, if not higher, than most other Western European economies. And I think that's the key issue. I think there is a challenge for the government to get that housing cost down. It's not something you can do very easily, but it certainly, I think, it is a key challenge that the government has to address. And that's why, you know, we made the recommendation about the devoting, you know, or ramping up the kind of the budget on housing, is because it needs to be addressed. It's a crucial issue, I think, going forward. In terms of, you know, clearly with borrowing, unfortunately, sometimes, particularly in the economics profession, people can develop, how would you say, almost blind spots about certain issues, you know? So if you look at in the German case, there is the kind of the obsession with inflation. And that obsession obviously goes back, it's kind of almost a political issue. It goes back to the role that inflation and hyperinflation played in the downfall of the Weimar Republic. So therefore, for generations, German economists and policymakers have almost been obsessed about inflation. In Ireland, there's almost a mini version of that, which is that a lot of commentators can remember the 1980s. And they can remember, I suppose, that the policy mistakes that were made in terms of the very high borrowing that was done. And I think there's almost a knee-jerk reaction against borrowing as a result. Going, you know, in the present period, we feel that, well, we can never ever go there again because we so badly handled it in the past. Whereas I think, you know, and again, as you referred to in the paper, we outlined a series of kind of conditions that should oversee any such policy. And one, obviously, as you pointed out there, is the crucial distinction between capital and current expenditure. Clearly, if you're investing in housing or investing in climate change or investing in Sláinte Care, these will all bring long-term returns to the economy. And so therefore, borrowing at very, very low rates of interest, you know, there's an inherent case to be made as far as we're concerned. What you don't want to go back to is what was done in the 1980s when the government was borrowing for current expenditure purposes. That's just not sustainable. So I think once those kind of distinctions are made, and I don't think it should be beyond the political process or beyond the kind of the general commentary around the political process to make those kind of distinctions, then I don't see any reason why you couldn't engage in such a policy.
And I think as well, isn't it significant, and you point this out in the paper, that the suspension of the EU fiscal rules and that kind of changing consensus at an EU level around borrowing, that is a significant change as well, that makes it, we're not in the context where we're trying to meet these very tight European fiscal rules. And do you see that likely to continue?
Yeah, I think there's a growing recognition of that at an EU level as well, which I think is important. You know, I think there seems to be, you know, more and more of a realization that, you know, we've a lot to learn in Europe, ironically, from the way in which, for example, the United States has gone about handling some of these situations recently. You know, so if you go back even and compare the way in which the US handled the financial crisis and the kind of stimulus that the Obama administration tried to bring in, that was in marked contrast to the kind of approach that the EU was taking at the time, you know, the kind of the austerity-driven approach, as it were, and the tightening of budgets at a time when, you know, the economies were all in free fall. So the fiscal rules, fiscal regimes probably grew out of that. And hopefully, you know, the pandemic, if it has had any silver lining, it is the extent that it is leading, I think. I mean, this process was undergoing anyway, and I think, interestingly, it was kind of coming from Germany, where there was a kind of a reevaluation of the kind of the approach that was taken, and that was very much from a German-centered approach. Let's face it; I think most people would agree with that. At the EU level, the kind of the drive for austerity was coming from very much kind of a German influence. But I think there was a big reawakening in German society, and even in German amongst German policymakers over the last 10 years. That mistake was misguided. And I think that, by definition, then has begun to seep into the broader European project. So I think there does seem to be a greater realization at a European level that the kind of approach that was taken in the past is not one that we, you know, obviously going forward, that we're going to that we should adopt. I think there's also recognition that in Europe, there is a kind of a growth problem generally there. Europe hasn't been growing over the last 10, 15, 20 years, anything like the way it grew before that period. And there, part of the question there, maybe a part of the remedy there, maybe a greater role for fiscal policy in terms of driving and facilitating investment in European economies, that is one way maybe to kind of kickstart growth in Europe, particularly now after the pandemic and after obviously the damage that the pandemic has done to many European economies. So I think, yeah, very much at the European level, there is, I think, a growing realization that we need to, you know, that the fiscal regimes that we've had have been too binding, have been too conservative, and that there is a greater role for fiscal policy in generating growth and generating economic activity. Obviously, the problem partly too is the fact that monetary policy, because of what they call the zero lower bound issue, the fact that interest rates are so low, monetary policy can't really do a whole lot more in terms of generating and stimulating growth. So that brings the emphasis back onto fiscal policy. So I think that's a, you know, I think that's certainly a change in tone and in the nature of the discussion.
One of the big things I think that's happened, the significant, I think, social and economic things that's happened over the last decade, and, you know, you make this point in your paper and previous papers that I've read, and you refer to it here again today, that, you know, this issue of growing unaffordability of housing has been growing really since the early decades of the 2000s, that it's a, you know, the and I think in large part it is related to, on the one hand, the state stopping essentially to build social and affordable housing on any scale, but also this growing what we call financialization of housing, the growing role, you know, initially during the Celtic Tiger period, it was the increased buy-to-let investors playing a role in housing. And I think now we are seeing institutional investors in a way replacing those and playing a very big role in our housing market. But the result of that is we have what is being referred to as generation rent. You know, a large group of particularly younger households, but not just younger households, excluded from what was considered part of the Irish social contract, which was that you could be able to buy your own home or at least access social housing. And where do you see the current housing market going and housing system going in Ireland based on current projections of that generation being able to get a home?
It's very, very difficult. I mean, I think the Irish housing market, I was just thinking a little bit about this, trying to summarize it in anticipation of the... It's the old story. You wouldn't start from here if you were devising a housing market. That's for sure. I think, I think some of it, I'm not so sure how conscious, a lot of it is down to bad policy making, you talked about the fact that the government has stepped back from the provision of social and affordable housing. I remember having an interesting conversation with somebody in the National Institute in London. So they're kind of a sister institute of ours some years back, and we were talking about the housing market, and they made this point about the UK, and we were kind of agreeing that it was a kind of a joint policy failure between the British and an Irish kind of approaches to the housing market, was this fact that the government in the UK had also stepped back from the provision of social and affordable housing, and that this was, it's not something which gets attention the first or second year that the government does it. But unfortunately, it builds up huge problems that take an awful long time to address. I mean, the fact that you have a large imbalance builds up, and you have a large cohort of people who are not being, you're not providing the kind of social and affordable housing for them. Unfortunately, when by the time the whole political process and the media kind of catches around to the issue and it becomes such a central issue, usually the problem has been building up for years, and therefore it's going to take a long time to resolve it, in terms of trying to address it. I think in the Irish case, I think there's a lot of issues. I think some of them go back, clearly are structural issues in terms of the kind of the way in which we have developed our cities, particularly Dublin, the kind of the sprawl issue, the fact that we have this preference like the British for the kind of the three-bed semi, and we like those kind of properties by definition or as a characteristic of the Irish psyche, as it were. And that lends itself to certain difficulties, the way the treatment of the land market. And I think obviously going back to the Kenny report and the way it discussed it back in the early 70s shows this isn't a problem of today or yesterday. But then I suppose the fact that we had this huge spurt of growth in the economy from the mid-90s onwards, probably no one could have foreseen the rate of growth that we would experience. And that caused, that ended up putting huge demand on the system. Suddenly demand was going through the roof, but the supply wasn't coming on stream, and then it wasn't coming on stream in the right places. And this all led to this huge surge in prices. And then on top of it all, then we had the deregulation in the financial sector, which allowed this massive splurge in credit. And in a way, that's kind of what happened, as it were, that people's affordability shot up, people at greater income levels, interest rates also were falling away since the mid-90s. So that all increased affordability. But prices shot up to a huge extent. Now, the way in which we plug that gap, as it were, there was a gap between, even though people's income levels had gone up and their interest rates were lower, there was still a gap between what people could afford based on traditional metrics and where the housing market was gone. And what happened was credit kind of came in, and credit was what ended up enabling people to spend so much on house prices. That's what fueled the demand, particularly towards the end of the Celtic Tiger. But obviously, you can't do that. I mean, it had catastrophic effects for the economy and for people in general. So now you're back into a problem where we have demand increasing, we have incomes going up, we have interest rates very low. We have these huge problems on the supply side. The credit situation is regulated with the macroprudential regulations, and that's where you have this affordability challenge coming in. And I think it is a very difficult situation to address. But I think the obvious answer to me, ultimately, is it's one of supply, but it's supply on a variety of bases. We need greater private sector role, but we also need the state to provide and to determine how many housing units it should be providing per annum going forward, and though that can be done easily enough, it's not that it can't be done. You can determine how much housing is required. I think it's not beyond the state, not beyond planners to say, we need X thousand number of units on a social and affordable basis, and then go ahead and just commit to providing those on a multi-annual basis. That is one thing of the recent plan, which is to be welcome, I think, is the multi-annual nature, that they have put finance in place for a number of years. Clearly, you'd like to see them maybe put it in place over a longer period. But, you know, that's the kind of policy that you need to have in place. You need to say the state is going to commit to provide 10,000 units per annum or 15,000 units per annum, however many, on a multi-annual basis over the next 5, 10, 15 years, and to continue to do it year in, year out. That's ultimately, I think, the way out of this. But it's not going to happen today or tomorrow, unfortunately. That's the problem.
And there's so many directions I could go on with this, and I'd love to rabbit holes. I'd love to take you down and chat on. I'm thinking there's many there, but one that comes to mind straight away is the question of numbers, because again, I was reading in your paper around that, and you raise it of, you know, what's the actual housing need, the housing demand that, you know, we're talking in the region of, you know, you estimate, I think in your paper, in the region of 35,000, obviously Housing for All is saying in the region of 33,000. But you make the point that that's a structural demand, which is basically the amount of households that are being formed and that, but it doesn't include the accumulated deficit of people haven't, essentially the demand we haven't met. And even if you did a rough calculation of, you know, we're probably building 15,000 of a deficit each year, over a decade, that's 150,000. That in actual fact, if you were saying the real needs there, and if you stick with me for a second, could be in the region of 50 to 55,000 homes per year. But of those, the big question is how many should be affordable? Because in the Housing for All plan, my estimation is probably about 15,000 is what they're talking about delivering as actual affordable. The rest are to come. So half it is to come from the private market, which we know at the moment the private market is predominantly providing what you would deem as unaffordable housing. It's either rents that are unaffordable for the majority of households. So if you were actually to put an estimate, if I was to push you and put an estimate on what's the actual affordable housing need per year, what figure would you put it in the region of?
I mean, I off the top of my head, I wouldn't have an actual, we haven't, anytime we determine the structural demand, and it's actually my colleagues, Del Bergen and Abby and Garcia Rodriguez who did that. It's usually just looking at it in an aggregate sense. We don't actually, you know, it's based on, as you say, household formation, demographics. It's a very, very sensitive estimate, by the way, to household formation. So I know this is something that Abby and Adele grappled with quite a bit. Is, you know, your assumptions around household formation rates going forward. If you were to have the Irish rate converge to a UK rate, for example, then you would see the housing demand jump up even much more so than what they're saying. So it is a very conservative, or it's a very sensitive estimate on that basis. I mean, in terms of how much is required, I mean, you know, what the figures you've talked about there are, you know, nobody can query with them, in my opinion, because it, as we've been saying, the 35,000, the 40,000 figure is a kind of an annual flow, but yet that has been met. Well, it certainly hasn't been met over the last 5 or 6 years. So you can tot up the numbers, if you like, the kind of accumulation that hasn't been met. So in an ideal world, I suppose you would be looking at providing, you know, a substantial increase in the numbers in terms of on the social and affordable. But I suppose it does come back to the extent of, well, how much can we actually afford to build year in, year out? That's probably the constraint more than anything, to be honest with you. And affordable, not just from the fiscal point of view, but affordable just from the point of view of actually getting the labor, getting the tradespeople, getting the capacity in place to do it. That is another binding constraint, I suppose, as far as the issue is concerned. So in terms of the numbers, it's, as I said, it's I couldn't quibble with the numbers that you've quoted there. When you look at it and try and work out what the actual requirement is today. But I guess in terms of the numbers that we've drawn out, I suppose we're looking at them as well on the social and affordable side, it being conditioned somewhat by the fiscal side of things and also by the capacity within the economy. There's no doubt that it is a challenge. And I don't think we should underestimate that if we do ratchet up, even whether it's private sector or public sector or a combination of both, it will mean that there's a sizable amount of economic activity coming from the housing sector again, And that, you know, we've got to be careful that we don't, A, that there's the capacity there to do that, but B, that it doesn't get to the stage that it did 10, 15 years ago, where it caused huge difficulties for the economy overall, you know?
Isn't there a real question in that, in the question of capacity, that we've essentially handed a monopoly situation over to the private sector to deliver housing, and that it would be financially prudent and wise for the state to actually set up something like a semi-state house building agency that would build homes and would offer competition to the private market and would offer guaranteed supply, would offer guaranteed contracts of employment, quality employment, and over time build up capacity. That the problem we've with our capacity is in part we have, it's in a sector, in the construction sector, and people, you know, with issues of working conditions, issues of contracts, issues of, you know, and you talk to young people, they don't want to go near the construction sector because they're going, why would I go there? It's going to be bust in 5 years' time again. There's no long-term security. That the state has to play a role in actually down to the level of guaranteeing the capacity.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, there's a number of different angles there. I guess one of the things, and I do think the initiation of, you know, the and the development so far of the Land Development Agency has been positive in the sense that it's centralizing some of these issues. Particularly, I think it makes more sense, for instance, in the provision of social and affordable housing. I don't know that you want to go back to the idea of each individual county council and you know, going off and doing its own thing. I think there'd be far more efficiencies to be gained, for instance, from one central provider of housing, social and affordable housing, from a national perspective, and whether somebody like the LDA is in place to deliver on that. Maybe that's one, but certainly I think that there is need for efficiencies and greater efficiencies in that regard. I think the answer to the problem generally does come about with an interaction between the private and the public sector. I don't see it being totally split either way. I do think there's a role for greater interaction between the two. I think if we are going to scale up, it's going to have implications for the construction sector generally, whether it's private or public. And I do think obviously there's a need to put greater emphasis on trades and the different kind of trade skills that are required. And you hear some of the stories about the numbers in the key areas, the key trades areas, and it's clear that we're looking at significant shortages in that regard going forward. So, and I think one of the things, again, you know, some of the measures in the recent act that look at the interaction between the Land Development Agency and some of the and those in the private sector, there may be scope there to try and incentivize production, etc. But it's clear if we are going to meet the overall targets that we need as a society, we do need both the public and the private sector to play a role. And I think getting greater interaction between the two is necessary if we're going to get the kind of scale that we are, that we basically require, you know?
Yeah. And another area is the question of how much of a change and challenge to the housing market and affordability is the growth of the role of institutional investors, the investment funds that are, you know, we know buying up most of apartments, for example, developing the build to rent sector, that they are in a way competing with and adding pressure to house prices, competing with home buyers, you know, making less homes available to buy, in a sense, obviously, of the supply, and therefore people who are trying to buy a home are more and more converging on a smaller amount of secondhand home supply, that they're playing. Well, obviously some economists are arguing very strongly that this is a, you know, supply and we need all supply. That is there a danger that institutional investors can play too much of a role, and particularly can play negative roles, for example, setting market rents in certain areas when they've a concentration of properties, you know, adding to the inflation of land prices, for example, that it's not necessarily all positive, the role that they play in a housing market?
No, well, I think the problem is, you see, is that the role that institutional investors can play, and they can play a very important role, and you could argue, you know, they came in at a time when there's very little credit or development going on in the housing market, rightly or wrongly, 4 or 5 years ago. The problem is that when there isn't the kind of the provision or adequate provision of social and affordable housing coming from the state, then you know, these investors are kind of operating in that vacuum, and it's leading then to people being priced out of the market who clearly cannot compete and cannot afford, if you like, the kind of rents and prices that these people are charging. So I think it's more the problem is it's reflecting the structure of the market and reflecting the absence of an adequate provision of social and affordable housing. I think if the state is active in providing a certain number of units per annum to meet over the longer term the kind of the requirements for social and affordable housing, then I think institutional investors can play a part in on the private side of the market for sure. But I think the problem we're seeing at the moment is the fact that you don't have the provision of sufficient adequate anything like the kind of numbers that you need on the social and affordable side. And then that's where the problem then is coming from, whoever it is on the private sector side, institutional investors or whoever are bidding up prices and bidding up rents and the like. So I think that's where the problem is. It's the fact that you don't have the adequate participation of the state over a period of time. It's not just 1 year, 2 years. This is the accumulation of 10, 15 years, we'll say. And I think that's the problem at the moment. It is an interesting issue in the sense that we did a paper a few years ago where we looked at, it was a longer term paper, where we looked at the provision of credit in general in the Irish economy. And if you look at what's happening in the Irish economy over the last period of time, you see that from the traditional sources of credit, if you like, the traditional financial sector, there's been no increase in credit or lending really over the last period of time. Credit levels have remained very, very flat. The only people who seem to be providing credit into the economy, and we can talk about, you know, there's obviously the difficulties associated with it as far as the housing market is concerned, but the only people who are providing credit, it would seem, are increasing the credit levels, are alternative sources of credit. And some of those, of course, are coming from the institutional investors. So it's a tricky issue. It's a difficult issue. But I think my take on it is that the basic problem is the lack of social and affordable housing and adequate numbers on that. I think that's where the problem is coming from. That would be my take on it.
And what do you take of, you've analysed as well, just the affordability measures of government, for example, the shared equity scheme and the help to buy scheme. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look on where we are now, do you hold that analysis that these are potentially, you know, policies that will worsen house prices essentially because they add to demand in a context of a lack of supply?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the basic laws of supply and demand apply, you know, they don't change in a matter of a couple of months, I'm afraid. And you know, when we outlined our position on the shared equity scheme, the difficulties around it, and there is, unfortunately, they're as valid now as they were when we initially outlined them, whenever that was, the start of this year or last year, when we were asked to, you know, in terms of our contribution at the joint or OCTA setting. So the difficulties associated with those measures are, you know, they're very, very clear and evident when you have a market where there is a relatively low supply level. The danger always is that those kind of measures get bid into higher prices. And I think that difficulty is obviously still there now today, as it was 6 months or 9 months ago. It's even more of a pressing issue, unfortunately, because of the pandemic, because the pandemic has slowed down the rate of housing supply, even though housing demand seems to be as strong as ever.
So do you think there should be a shared equity scheme as they're proposing in place?
No, I mean, our position on it is very clear. We outlined our concerns about it, you know, and we wouldn't favor such an approach. I mean, the idea, the basic principles behind it in terms of increasing or stimulating demand and whilst you have, you know, supply remaining relatively fixed, that unfortunately has inflationary implications and inflationary consequences. There's, you know, that's incontrovertible, really. And we're not the only ones, obviously. The central bank said the same thing, and even senior civil servants and other government departments argued the same thing.
And why, in that context, then, do you think government is continuing to pursue the policy?
It obviously will make some difference to some people at the margin. You know, maybe there's a perception from, you know, it's obviously these measures are more, there's more of a political element to them possibly than anything else. So, you know, they may help some people at the margin, as it were, in terms of affordability and in terms of getting on the property ladder. But I suppose, you know, our concern with them always is to look at them in the aggregate and look at the overall effect of these measures. And that's where our concerns would arise from.
And just before we come to a close, I know I promised you half an hour, we're still going. So I appreciate you giving the time. It's really, no, it's so important, I think, because housing, I think, is so central to people's lives, and we can see the human cost mm-hmm. of the social damage that's been done to people. And I do, like, one of my big fears actually is that, you know, a lot of young people, not just young people, are going to emigrate. Yeah. And that's a massive yeah. loss of human capital and social capital and, mm. you know, what we've done. And to me, it feels as if we're still tinkering around the edges, and that, you know, what you propose in this paper, because you actually went even further, if I'm correct in my analysis, you said there was potentially 4 to 7 billion a year capacity. So theoretically, you could borrow 3 billion a year for housing. I know the question then is the capacity to deliver it.
Yeah.
But you could borrow that.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues as well, in terms of the numbers, that in the paper, a few people contacted us afterwards. Obviously, we took our numbers, you know, when we said if you double the capital expenditure, you might get up to this number of units. There was a few people queried those numbers and suggested that, you know, maybe we based them basically on the Department of Housing information, that maybe that information wasn't as up to date.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, during the pandemic, you've seen a significant increase in housing costs for a variety of different. So it may actually, to get that same kind of increase in the number of units, it may actually require additional expenditure above and beyond what we said in the paper. So it actually could be even costlier again. So, look, it's a huge problem. It's been allowed to develop over years. Unfortunately, it's going to take a while to sort it. But clearly, you need to have significant. You need to make a substantial start right now. You know, I can't wait for any more time. As you said there about immigration, the reason I got interested in economics was I could remember back to the 1980s, and it was just such a bleak period. The reason people didn't emigrate, the reason people emigrated back then was they had no jobs and there was no career prospects or very few career prospects for people back then. It would be a shame if 30 years later, when we seem to be providing lots of employment for people, lots of opportunities for people, but we don't seem to be able to provide affordable accommodation for people. That, to me, I mean, it would be an awful shame if we had a significant increase in emigration because of that. Again, you're kind of saying, well, what's the whole point of solving one economic problem if you end up, you know, with another economic problem that ends up with the same, you know, effect as far as things like immigration is concerned.
And I think the most frustrating thing of this is, you know, you're absolutely right there, is this is not rocket science.
It's not. I mean, I think it's very clear. And look, the other issue is that we did it before. You know, there was a time in this country when we were significantly poorer, when we didn't have anything like the resources we presently have, where we did build a huge amount of social and affordable housing. You know, you go back to the 30s, the 40s, even into the early 1970s, I remember looking at the data and you could see that up to a third of housing construction was coming from the provision of you know, the old style kind of provision of council housing, I suppose you would have called it back then. So it's not like we haven't done it before, and it's not like we haven't done it at a time when we didn't have the resources that we presently have. So you know, you just need a focus on it, and it needs to be. And as I said, you need multi-annual commitments, really. And you know, when government outlines targets, etc., those targets have got to be met and met on an ongoing basis, rather than just being set out in kind of policy documents from time to time. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, Kieran, I really appreciate you giving the time. It was a fantastic conversation. I know listeners will get a huge amount out of it, and I hope it's shared far and wide as an educational resource. And I appreciate all the work you're doing on it. So thank you very much for coming on Reboot.
Not today. At all. And thank you very much. And enjoy the chat. Enjoy the discussion.
Great. And Kieran, we'd love to have you back at some point in the future.
Sure.
Great. And reminder to our listeners, we are an independent podcast. We have no sponsorship, no advertising. We have lots of listeners, and we appreciate you who are listening and who give the time. And if you can, you can become a supporter of Reboot Republic. You can go over to tortoiseshack.com/Patreon, which is the wrong way around. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I always get it the wrong way around. But please do become a supporter. Sign up for what you can each month. Help us to keep run the cost of producing these podcasts. Keep them going. Keep great voices like Kieran, the analysis. It is an education resource. It is a resource that's feeding in ideas to the country into where we can do and what we can do and what can be done and what's possible. So if you can, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, sign up, become a supporter. And thank you very much for listening, and we will talk to you all soon.